Next case for argument, United States v. Crisp. Mr. Patton.
Morning, Your Honors. When a sentencing statute says that the court can make a particular finding and based on that finding take action, the court means the judge, not the probation officer. In the statute at issue here...
Counsel, the premise of your brief seems to be that this order makes the probation officer the final determiner of ability to pay. Is that a sensible way to read the order? The alternative way to read the order is to say the probation office takes the first cut, and if the defendant doesn't think that's a correct decision, then the judge will make a decision. Why shouldn't we read it the latter way?
Because the order says you shall pay for these services, if financially able, as directed by the U.S. probation office. That's what it says. It doesn't say
if financially able. Whether he's financially able is directed. You know, your reading would be more sensible if it said, if financially able, as determined by.
Right.
Right? The way in which it reads, it sounds like the probation office is going to direct him to pay if he's financially able. And we have up in the air who determines whether he's financially able. My question, in other words, is why are you reading this to make this the worst it can be for your client, rather than the best it can be for your client?
Because I argued to the judge, my client has a negative net worth of $3,996.
This is going to come into force in 20 years. Who knows what his worth will be? Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, he's going to be in prison for 14 years. I have been doing this for 20 years in August. I have never had a client come out of the Bureau of Prisons more wealthy than they went in.
So why is this a ripe decision that we should even worry about right now?
Because
if he's never going to be able to pay, this whole dispute is irrelevant.
Well, no, because this is the way, in practice, the ability to pay gets determined, at least in the Central District of Illinois.
And as a practical matter, it's always going to be determined by probation officers in the first instance, right?
No, not if the judge, just said, looked at his financial situation and said, you know what, this man is indigent. He does not have funds available for payment.
No one can say now who can pay and how much in 15 years. The only thing you can do is say, we'll figure it out in 15 years. And then the question is, does the judge have to try to do this by himself, or does he do it on the recommendation of the probation office? One of these makes no sense.
I would say the way it's done in here makes no sense, because it is the probation officer that's making the decision. If the person has money, Mr. Crisp will meet with his probation officer.
Exactly.
His probation officer says,
I conclude that you can pay, and he says, no, I can't. The judge is going to have to settle that dispute.
That is if Mr. Crisp, working pro se on his own, has the wherewithal to say, you know what, I don't like this. Number one, this probation officer has an enormous control over my life. He's the one that is representing the judge. I've had multiple clients where we get these modifications that come in. They get done serving their sentence. All of a sudden, I see on a docket sheet, because I'm still on the docket sheet, my former client has agreed to pretty major modifications in the terms of their supervisor release that are not to their benefit, but they've signed a modification form agreeing to. The probation officer has gone to them and got them to sign this piece of paper that says, I waive my right to a hearing under Rule 32.1 and agree to the modification of my conditions. I call up my former client and say, why did you agree to this? I could do better for you than this. One of two answers invariably happen. It's, well, they're the probation office. They told me that they work for the judge, and so I'm assuming if they're telling me you want this to happen, that means the judge wants it to happen. Or number two, the probation officer says, if you don't agree with this, we're going to have a hearing. The last time these people had a hearing in front of the district judge, they went away to prison for a long time. So they are very intimidated.
Well, do you think it would be improper for the judge to ask the probation officer what he knew about the defendant's financial prospects?
Not at all. In the probation office, what they do is they have, I believe it's a probation form 48. It is a short net worth statement, and there's also a monthly cash flow statement. And the net worth, there's a long form and a short form. All of my clients get the short form because their net worth, they have very few assets. The liabilities, they usually just look at their credit report to get all their liabilities. The monthly cash flow statement's a pre-printed form that on the one side has all the possible different sources of income you
can
think
of. Well,
would
it deal with your concerns if the judge said to the defendant, the probation officer knows more about you than I do, and he will make a judgment as to whether you can afford to pay any of the costs of this program. But if you disagree with his assessment, you can always complain to me.
Look, it would be better than what happened here. My preferred method would be for the judge to say, you don't have any money. You have less than no money. You're going to prison for 14 years. I am going to find you do not have the ability to pay for treatment services.
That would make no sense. Judge can't determine in 2015 what somebody's ability will be in 2030.
That's why my thought...
If a judge did think he could say that, he would be insane.
The rest of my sentence was going to be the judge could say to the probation officers, if you feel there has been a material change in the person's financial situation, if somehow they have become wealthy in the 14 years that they've been incarcerated, probation, you can file a request to modify the conditions and ask me to make a finding that the person now does have the ability to pay.
Mr. And Patton, so, in a related issue, you know, we've said, for example, that the judge has to decide how often drug tests can be performed, right?
Yes, sir.
And so now we see supervised release orders that say up to 104 drug tests per year, right? Which obviously is a practical matter, a delegation to the probation office, right? I would frankly expect pretty much the same kind of response if we were to agree with you here.
Well, the government makes that argument on page 30 of their brief that says basically if you say the judge has to do this, in reality all that's going to happen is the judge is going to meet with the probation officer in private and let the probation officer...
Well, there are other ways to do it, but as a practical matter, this is something where the probation officers are going to be the first line of responsibility, right?
The probation officers are always going to be the first people that gather the information. The same way they're the people when they're doing the pre-sentence report, they're the ones that gather the facts. But then it's the judge that makes the sentencing determinations based on those facts. Of course, the probation office is going to be the first line of gathering the financial information. I completely understand that, and I don't have any problem with that. The problem is then looking at these statements and saying, all right, you've got, and look, they sit down with these people and say, all right, you've got an extra $100 coming in this month. You can pay $10 or $15 towards your drug treatment, mm-hmm. which I think makes absolutely no sense for, you know, somebody
well,
that's going
to
be.
There is a philosophy having to do with punishment that says that paying for part of the punishment is, in fact, part of the rehabilitative process, right?
But supervised release is not supposed to be for punishment purposes. It's supposed to be for rehabilitation purposes.
That's what I'm talking about. It's part of the sentence, as your office reminds us so often, and how punitive and overbearing these different provisions are. But with respect to paying part of the costs, that can be thought to have a rehabilitative purpose.
If it's a fine or restitution, I can agree with that. But for drug services that you are telling the person, you have to go take these drug, mm-hmm. go to these drug programs, or we will send you to jail if you violate and don't go to them. And then to say, you have to pay for it so that you understand that you're being punished, after the guy spent 14 years
in
prison,
taking responsibility, that you're taking responsibility. Let me ask you a different question. If we agree with you, Mr. Patton, why would the remedy be the complete resentencing that you're talking about here?
Your Honor, in this case, if you wanted to limit it to a remand to adjust the condition, we would be fine with that. I mean, look, if I can get the full resentencing remedy, I'd take it. I mean, the guy got a full resentencing last time. Mr. Crisp got a full resentencing, and his sentence was reduced by 6 years. Yep, that was a good result, and it's because he did very well in the Bureau of Prisons, and we showed that to Judge Shadid, and Judge Shadid found under U.S. versus Pepper that he had post-sentencing rehabilitation, and so he reduced the sentence. And look, I'm not going to...
Is there any rationale for a complete resentencing to fix this problem, if it's a problem?
No, you know, I can't sit here and tell you that, you know, it would be... There's a good rationale for a complete
could you just
resentencing.
Briefly tell us why you think the differences we're talking about here are so important that we should force a circuit split?
Because the language of 3672 is absolutely clear.
No, it isn't. Judge Easterbrook pointed that out.
If you're going to say that the court means that the probation officer can make the determination, and if the defendant doesn't like it, then the defendant can go ask the judge about it, then the probation officer is making the determination. It's saying the judge only has to make the determination if the client objects.
What circuits have said is that it's permissible for a judge to allow the probation officer to make a final decision. That's real delegation. None of us is talking about that. And that's why I wondered why you wanted to read this as real delegation. Because we might always say, gee, we agree with the Fifth Circuit. You can't even complain to the judge. But you presumably don't want that to happen.
No, I don't. But I just believe it is unrealistic to put the burden on the most unsophisticated person to say, if you think the probation office is doing this wrong, it's your burden to come to the judge and ask them to change it.
But what are you going to do with the rest of the conditions of supervised release? Your argument applies equally to them, that you'd want the judge to, if he has a, that if he says, no, if the condition says no excessive consumption of alcohol, then you're saying the judge has to specify in ounces or...
Well, that's what the Thompson case says, that he has to put it in a blood alcohol level or something. You can't use excessive. But for those conditions, Your Honor, if the probation officer is of the opinion that the defendant is not in compliance, they file a petition with the court and ask the court to make a determination of whether the person in fact violated.
That's what's going to happen here too. If the probation officer says you can pay $100 and the defendant doesn't, there'll have to be a petition filed with the court.
That is, if that's the way it goes down, Your Honor, but for most people under supervision are going to say, the probation officer is going to say, you have to pay me, you got to pay the government $50 this month or $50 a month. Unless, I guess, they get told in the language of the condition that if you don't agree with this, come back and I will decide it as the judge. The vast majority of people under supervision just don't understand, and they don't have counsel with them when this is going on. They only get counsel reappointed if they on their own say, well, okay, I don't want to agree to this, I want to have a hearing. And just very few of them do that because they aren't very sophisticated and they're afraid of going back to court even if they think they're right. It's a very
small percentage. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Patton. Ms. Boyle?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Boyle on behalf of the United States. First, to specifically address defense counsel's argument regarding the language of 3672, we agree, obviously, that the statute says the court, but we also agree with the four circuits, the 4th, 5th, 9th, and 11th, that have decided that Mr. Patton's advocated plain language approach is not correct, and the language in the statute is not perfectly clear. There are many compelling reasons to show that the district court did not abuse its discretion in imposing the supervised release condition at issue in this case. From a policy standpoint, as Your Honors have noted, the probation office is definitely the best position to deal with supervised release issues such as this. But the buck still stops with the court. The probation office's goal is to aid reentry, rehabilitation, and to reduce recidivism. The probation office does not have an interest in imposing a fine on the defendant that the defendant cannot pay. The probation office also monitors the defendant's reentry and finances. In fact, the U.S. sentencing guidelines require the probation office, require an ex-offender on supervised release to notify the probation office of a change in economic circumstances.
Do they ever pay?
Pardon?
Do these people ever pay?
Well, Your Honor, I've only been with the U.S. Attorney's Office for about 10 months now, but I have not seen anybody required to pay. And anecdotally, obviously not based on the record, from what other prosecutors in my office have said, it doesn't sound like it happens frequently. Your Honor, probation also has flexibility to deal with the defendant's changing financial circumstances in a way that the district court simply does not. If the judge determines ability to pay, a person on supervised release will have to move to modify the court when their financial circumstances change. This could implicate the adversarial process, and it's also going to be time-consuming for the judiciary. The alternative is a very simple conversation with the person's probation officer. As we noted in our brief, I think there's an additionally huge transparency issue here. The district court judge is likely to rely on the probation office to make the financial ability to pay determination, and that's for good reasons. It's for the reasons we discussed above. Probation is going to be the person who is up there, with the defendant and discussing their financial circumstances, any loss of job, any change in income, things like that. What you're looking at then is whether you have an overt delegation to the probation office, which is what we have here, or if you have what's more of a hidden effectual delegation. This presents a problem for the defendant, because if there's a hidden effectual delegation, the defendant is not going to be able to challenge the probation office's decision in the same way. As it stands, if probation makes a decision, the defendant has the opportunity to bring that decision before the district court. If we have a hidden effectual delegation, then you have a defendant who's in a position of having to appeal to this court in order to get relief. So in essence, they kind of miss one of their opportunities to challenge the
You agree, however, that people on supervised release do not have a right to counsel in dealing with these issues unless they're charged with a violation?
I understand that, Your Honor. I think that's another issue that shows how the court could get involved, because if you have probation making the ability to pay determination, and then you have probation deciding that the defendant is not complying with the payment requirements, as Judge Easterbrook noted, probation will file a petition to revoke with the court. It will end up before the court, and the judge will make a determination as to whether the defendant is in violation of supervised release or not.
That's a pretty high-risk method of bringing the dispute before the final decision-maker, isn't it?
It is a way to ensure that the defendant has counsel for the financial ability to pay determination, Your Honor. But
That's a pretty tough choice.
Our point generally is that, first of all, we think that probation doesn't have an interest in forcing people to pay that they think can't pay. That's not in line with their rehabilitative goals. And in the event that there is some issue, I will say, and this is not really based on the record either, but I know Mr. Patton asserted in the resentencing hearing that his office had seen disputes over the years between probation and defendants. An anecdotal survey of prosecutors in my office, nobody had seen anything like that come before the court or the U.S. Attorney's Office. So in the rare event there is a dispute with probation over a defendant's ability to pay, and the probation officer chose to file a petition to revoke, you're going to have the judge reviewing that decision, which is essentially what's been asked for here. I'd also like to just briefly address the fine and restitution statutes defense counsel cites and urges a similar interpretation of the court. We believe that those statutes are presented in a different context. The supervised release condition here permits the probation office to determine ability to pay in the context of a statute that just discusses making a general finding regarding ability to pay. As the Ninth Circuit stated in Dupas, that's all the court is looking for, and the Fifth Circuit and Warden found that the ability to pay determination is specifically a fact-finding determination. It's very different from establishing a specific payment schedule and doesn't implicate core judicial functions in the same way. The judge still retains the power to order substance abuse treatment or no. Your Honors, I'd also like to reiterate that we also don't believe there's any need for a full remand in this case. We believe that, first of all, we don't believe there's need for a remand at all, of course, but to the extent that the court disagrees, we would ask that it just be narrowly remanded based on the supervised release issues.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Boyle.
Thank you.
Mr. Patton, time ran out. You can have another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, these folks do pay. Now, most of the time, they're not paying the full amount of the treatment, okay? But they sit down with the probation office, and the probation office is making... It's not even like the restitution order where the judge says, I'm finding this is restitution. And then the probation is just trying to enforce that. This is the probation office in the first instance is making the determination. Do I find, as the probation office, you have the ability to pay for this? And it has very real implications. Mr. Crisp, if you look at the transcript of the original sentencing, it's on page 28, it's docket entry 33. He went back to selling drugs. What Ms. Pollack told the court is he's working a minimum wage job. They have a new baby. He doesn't have money. He knows one way to make money, quick, and make a lot of it, and that's selling drugs. He gets stressed. He gets financially stressed, and so he's like, I know one way to do it. Why you want to keep these folks that are poor to start with? And if they can find a job coming out as convicted felons or multiple convicted felons, and then say, you know, if you have any extra at the end of the month, we want to take it.
It doesn't sound like this has anything to do with the argument you're making. You just disagree with the basic order to pay.
I agree with the basic...
You're not now arguing about who's going to decide.
But they are related. I believe they are related.
Counsel, you can't win that on the statute, and of course you know this has already been decided in the Seventh Circuit. So you might at least want to concentrate your argument on the remaining open issues.
Your Honor, if the judge has to make the determination of whether or not a person has the ability to pay, and the statute says the court has to make the determination if they have the ability to pay, having the probation officer every month look at the person's finances and decide yes, you can pay, or no, you can't, is not the court making the determination in the first instance is if there is the ability to pay. It is the probation officer making the determination with the consolation that if the defendant has enough...
Probation officer is going to know a lot more about the defendant than the judge does.
Sure, but you could make that argument at the initial sentencing because the probation officer is the one that did the pre-sentence report. So you could say the probation officer knows more about the defendant then than the judge, but the probation officer turns the facts they gather over to the judge, and then the judge makes the determination. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Powell.